This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Bransky, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org. and www.acornradio.org. The podcast will be available this show on those websites as well as affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Eric David Dawson, who's the director of a program called Peace First, but he's also written a book called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. Welcome to Wade's World, Eric.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So tell our audience kind of exactly what Peace First is, and then we'll get into the book and what your program is.
Yeah, so Peace First was started by young people in Boston, actually. I was one of them, around a pretty big idea, which is that if we are going to do anything to improve our world, make sure that people have access to food and safe drinking water and quality education and our communities are just and safe and prosperous, the most important thing we can do is support young people to lead that change. And so we train and support young people all over the globe to imagine and create and design social justice projects. We believe that young people are not only capable of doing incredible work, but they're actually essential to the beloved community we want to build.
Now, when you're talking about peace, are you talking about security, or are you talking about war, or what are we really trying to grab here?
So it's a great question, and we chose the word peace to ground our work in, and more specifically, peacemaking. So we spend so much time telling young people what not to do, right? Don't do drugs, don't smoke, don't drop out of school. Our whole narrative around young people is negative. And so we wanted to offer something positive, something universal, something creative. And so for us, peace is about doing our work and living our lives with three values. One is compassion, so crossing lines of difference to bring other people into the circle, to make the circle bigger, to do our work with love. The second is courage, to take risks, to stand up for someone else, to not just ask, what do I get out of something, and not just what can I give, but what am I willing to give up? How am I willing to create space for other people?
Gotcha.
And then finally, collaborative leadership. So moving away from the story that it's individuals who drive change and reflecting how change happens, which is networks of people coming together. So peacemaking for us is the embodiment of compassion, courage, and collaboration.
And when you talk about focusing on young people, what's the age group you're really trying to target here?
So my book is written for ages 10 and up, and it's basically a manifesto for how to be a good person. We ask young people all the time, what do you want to do when you grow up? But we don't ask young people, who do you want to be, and how can I help you be that person? So it is a mixture of stories of young people who've led change, and then it's the how-to guide, how each young person, wherever they are, whoever they are, can create a powerful, impactful justice project. And then we have a companion digital platform, so at peacefirst.org, we have a network of young people from 126 countries who are building and creating and designing really amazing projects. And for that, the age range is 13 to 25.
150, 160 countries in the world, so you're 120. That's a huge network.
It is, yeah. We've got a great group of amazing, thoughtful, caring young people that we get to support to do great work.
Well, I want to hear how you put that together. But you started this when you were pretty young yourself, as I recall reading the book.
Yeah, I was 18. And because of the scholarship I had, you know, rather than doing a job in the cafeteria or cleaning dorms, I got to do volunteer work. So this was my freshman year work study project. And so I've been at this for 26 years, which either means a deep personal commitment or a lack of professional ambition. I'm not sure which.
You're talking to somebody who started work at 20 as an organizer, and this is what I still do. So I'm not going to even touch that comment, Eric. But, so did Peace First exist when you started your work study, or did you found it?
So it was co-founded. So there was a group of young people. There was a professor of children's literature named Francilia Butler who had run these peace festivals of bringing kids together in Connecticut. And she had been looking for a place to pass this festival on, and a group of students at Harvard where I was studying took this idea of bringing young people together and began building a curriculum around it and then scaling that. And in the past couple of years, we've become basically the back office for this generation's Gandhis, Dr. Kings, Ella Bakers, these culture creators, inventors, dreamers who want to change the world but don't always know how to get started.
Gotcha. Well, that's everybody. And so you then, but you're directing the program at this point, or you're part of a team directing it?
So we have a staff of about 20, and then a network of hundreds and hundreds of folks like you, storytellers, caring adult mentors who want to support young people on their journeys. And because the work is digital, our mentors could be doing this on their lunch hour or on their commute or on a Saturday. It's a huge tent because, as we know, social change happens when we all join together with whatever our superpowers are to create something bigger than we can create on our own.
Exactly. So in the book, and Eric has written a book that's recently been published by Viking called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. Let's give us some sense of what these seven commitments are, because you, in the book, tell these stories, as you say, emphasizing each one of these commitments.
Yeah, so I wanted to invite young people to think differently. And so, you know, it starts with putting peace first every day, making a commitment to raise your hand, to volunteer, to say, I'm the one who's going to make a difference, to open your heart, to act with kindness, to understand the needs of others, especially people that we disagree with, and then to work with our enemies. So to find those unlikely allies and push ourselves to find common ground, and of course to bring others along. How do we invite others to join us to create change? And to end with this chapter called "Keep Trying." You know, so often the first things we do are the second things, or the 20th things aren't successful. And the story I tell, there's this amazing young woman from Atlanta named Mary Pat. And as a 15-year-old, she shared with me she had been to more funerals and graduations because of gun violence. And so she wanted to use the same ideas that advertisers use to get people to stop smoking or to not use drugs, these shock ads, but to do that around gun violence. And she probably talked to 50 organizations, all of whom said, no, this idea will never work. And finally, we gave her $50,000 to get this off the ground. She did it in one police precinct in Atlanta. The police did a survey, and the place where she put up these billboards to get young people not to pick up guns to shoot one another was the only place that had a dramatic decrease in gun violence. Like, it was a project that actually worked and had data behind it. And no one would fund it. No one believed that a young person could lead and create this change. And so many young people get those experiences. So I wanted to tell stories not just of these superstar successes, but the complexity of what it means to work for justice.
Although the sister in Atlanta sounds like she's something of a superstar too, huh, Eric?
Yeah, and what's interesting, Mary Pat was also the first person, the youngest person to run for office in Georgia And again, had an adult who she was running against who filed a lawsuit that she didn't have a right to be on the ballot, which she won, saying that young people can actually run for office. And so, you know, again and again, I think we as adults, sometimes good intentioned, tend to see young people as victims or perpetrators or the future. And so we don't invest in young people with our time, with our money, with our mentorship in the way that we should.
So in trying to then get this book out to people and these stories, these various commitments, all of which, you know, when you read them, hey, you know, that's good common sense. That's exactly right. I mean, we often say you only really lose a campaign when you stop fighting. I mean, let's keep in trying. I mean, we're in organizing, we're often known for relentless persistence.
Yes.
Maybe that should be, you know, commitment number 7, subset number 3 or whatever. But so how mechanically do you connect to all these mentors and individuals around this 120 countries where Peace First is working?
So you should think of our digital platform as like a gathering place for young leaders where they get to collaborate, they get to share, they do multiple languages. And we built the world's largest marketplace of youth-led, youth-created social innovations. And then we invite parent adults in to come and be part of that. And so it's kind of like doing a science fair, except it's a science fair for social justice, where we help young people step-by-step create a project, identify their issues, research it, and then launch something. And they get to do this within this caring ecosystem of mentorship, of dollars if they need it. And what my book does is it takes those same practices, those same tools, and puts them in language that a fifth grader or an eighth grader could use in their living room, in their faith-based settings, in a school, step-by-step demystifying what it means to be a social justice worker.
Now, do you get much buy-in on this program from schools?
So, first of all, I have a deep love for educators and the work that I do. You know, I was trained as an educator. And, you know, so often we are trained to teach, to impart wisdom, to look at young people as sort of vessels that we need to fill with knowledge and curiosity. And so I think the intention is there, but the practice is where we often fall down. So a lot of our work with adults is actually to help young adults step back and to create space for authentic leadership. So there's a ton of interest from schools around youth voice, around youth activism, but when it actually happens, I find that adults can have a hard time stepping back and sort of making space for the messiness that is organizing.
Which is an elegant way of saying that often adults are resisting these efforts of youth to put Peace First, right?
The heart is there, but the intent is not what they need to be.
I often say that people want to say yes even when they're saying no. So, yeah, I understand. Who knows what the audience is getting, but I understand exactly what you're talking about, Eric. This is not necessarily a program that schools are pushing out for you, so you're needing to use your digital platform really to connect. And
that's right.
And in terms of, obviously 120 countries, I haven't looked at this is my bad. I didn't look at the website before I called you for this interview, but clearly you've got a lot of language barriers you're also climbing over.
Well, and this is the amazing thing about technology, the ability to do instant translations, the ability to help people communicate across differences exponentially better than it was even 3 or 4 years ago.
I often explain the only way we can build Acorn International is because we have the, you know, Internet and Google Translate. Yeah.
That's right. The bigger issue, I think, is creating the cultural relevance. It's not just the language, it's the meaning behind the language. Sure. And because the website and even my book, The Stories, they're co-created by young people. So young people are finding those connections. They're creating the cultural relevance for other young people, not just in terms of the language, but, you know, the cultural meaning of what justice looks like in Saudi Arabia is different than what justice looks like in Detroit. And so how do we help young people bring these ideas into their own context and make it theirs?
And the concept of justice in Saudi Arabia is very, you know, that's an interesting topic in itself these days. And so which countries have you found the most enthusiasm for the program? I mean, there's always, you know, some places that are better than others in terms of being first adapters to a new program like this.
It's a great question, and I'm still learning as we grow. I found one interesting through line, and I'm not ready to claim this as a truth, but it's the hypothesis, which is division around access to wealth and privilege. So what I'm finding is that wealthier communities, that those young people actually have the tools and resources to get projects off the ground, but actually don't know what they care about. They're not quite sure what they want to tackle. And then young people who don't have those privileges, who sit at the bottom of the privilege pyramid, know exactly what they want to fix, but aren't quite sure how to do their projects. And so this book and our digital platform really helps both groups of young people, those who know exactly what they want to solve but aren't sure where to get started, and those who know how to make a project happen and to mobilize their resources, but need some help figuring out what they really care about.
And that brings up the issue of, I mean, that's a very astute point. So you mentioned on the Atlanta example, being able to put $50,000 behind that project. That can't be something you can do every day in every place.
Unfortunately, we can't. What we are doing is we're in the process of raising the world's largest fund that will invest directly in young people's social change work. It's never been done in the history of the human race. We do not invest dollars directly in the hands of young people. We invest it around them. But when we give young people these $250 mini grants to get started, it goes to young people. They get to choose how the money gets spent, where it goes. We try to get them in 2 or 3 days after they've completed their plan and their budget. They don't have to keep receipts, right? Our whole message to young people is we trust you. So we're in the process of raising what will be a $10 million fund that will just invest in young people's ideas to build this amazing, peaceful, just, connected world.
Well, that's an ambitious goal. And that must be a way that you get to spend a lot of your free time.
One of the things I love about my job, you know, a lot of us, you know, who get into the work that we do, whether it's organizing or education, then get pulled into administration and then often get pulled into fundraising and kind of like feel our souls being slowly crushed by needing to spend all this time asking for money. I love it. And the reason I love it is because there are so many hungry adults and institutions who are moved by the student organizers in Parkland, who are amazed by the youth leadership behind the Women's March. And they want to back those young people, but don't want to just send a check to the ACLU. Great organization. But they actually want to get those dollars in the hands of young people to support their projects. So I'm able to serve as this broker between people with immense wealth. I mean, $10 million is nothing. You know, somewhere out there, there's someone who's spending that, you know, just to maintain their homes. We need to re-envision where those dollars need to go. You know, I have 3 degrees from Harvard. I love the institution. I got a lot out of it. And I have never and probably will never give them a dime. They don't need money from me to build their whatever billion-dollar endowment. Those are the questions we need to be asking, right? So when I say we want to raise a $10 million youth fund, like your reaction should be, no, it needs to be $10 billion, because that's the kind of energy we need to be putting behind young people, because that's how much Harvard's going to raise to do whatever they're going to do next, right?
Right, which is give a small percentage of that to some loans to some, you know, folks they want to pick out of some, you know, rural area or some, you know, low-income thing and say that they have more diversity. But we won't, once again, I won't get off the subject, but I can see why you're a good fundraiser because, you know, it's hard to believe. I wish I believed that so many people thought that it was a good thing for youth to get those kind of funds. But you're exactly right. $10 million is chump change these days in terms of what the concentration of wealth is. And we look at the money raised in politics and you say, oh, my God, I mean, this is not the bar bill for most of these campaigns. So we're talking to Eric Dawson, who's directing Peace First, has also written a book called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. And luckily, in talking about the book, we're able to talk about this very interesting network. I don't even know if we ever call it an organization, but network of people he's put together. You mentioned earlier, Eric, mentors. How do you connect these mentors to these young activists and people who are interested in putting people first?
So on our website, Care and Adults can sign up to mentor. And we've built one of the best online training programs for mentors. So we teach them how to be a caring adult, how to support young people through the projects. And then we match them with a young person. And the cool thing that we do, which is very unusual, is young people get to choose their mentors. So they get to figure out what they need, who they need, what questions they have. And then the mentor helps them along their journey, answering questions, offering encouragement, connecting them with resources. And because the mentoring is all public, it's all visible. I mean, that's both for safety issues, but it also means that every time a mentor gives a piece of advice or answers a question, that gets captured in a library of ideas and research and resources.
Well, I was going to ask about the security thing. That's a very good tool, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a message that everything we do is visible. Every young person's project, all their innovations get shared. This is not about each of us owning one thing. It's about how do we collectively join our efforts to build something bigger, more beautiful than we could do on our own.
And do the young people also connect to each other? I assume there must be a mechanism for that as well.
They do. Yeah, one of my favorite projects we're supporting is a young woman who's working on the issue of cyberbullying, particularly in the online gaming world. She's a gamer, and the gaming world can be a horrible place for girls and women. It's incredibly sexist, and she's badly bullied from that. And so she wanted to create a pro-female, open-to-everyone gaming community and had never been to a university and was able to put out, like, how do I partner with a university? And, you know, young people just swirled around her, offering their advice, offering connections, and offering help.
And stumbling on the question, but have you monitored some of these young people and what they, I mean, talking about the woman in Atlanta, obviously you know she ran for office, you know this, that, and the other, so she's a great example of somebody you've really kept a relationship with fairly closely through the organization. Can you tell what other programs or projects that some of these young people that get involved in Peace First are putting together now with this experience?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of like you know, asking me who my favorite child is. Like, there's so many powerful, amazing stories that the young people are doing. I think about a group out of New York. This was started by a group of 14-year-old girls who, I don't know if you heard this. This was a new concept to me. It's called lunch shaming, where basically what happens is in school districts where kids fall behind in their lunch dues, their weekly lunch bills, they'll get their name printed in the paper. They'll get their hand stamped. In some cases, when in the lunch line, they will literally have their lunch taken away from them and given the government-mandated cheese sandwich and white bread. It's horrible on so many levels. And so they created this app to help young people who've got a few extra dollars be able to contribute to kids who need a few extra dollars. Or there's this really amazing project in South Texas that it's huge number of immigrants from Mexico, and because of this happenstance, a huge number of Syrian refugees. And these Syrian refugees and these Mexican immigrants, young people, didn't connect at all in their school. And so the young people decided to organize afternoon teas where the Syrian and Mexican students could sit down and get to know one another over fancy tea settings. You know, there's a group that's of two young women who went through the foster care system, who realized that the teens in the foster care system moved from home to home to home carrying garbage bags and clothes, and so they opened a boutique where kids in the foster care system could, you know, quote unquote, shop for new clothes that they get donated. They actually have a store now in their community. I can go on and on.
I bet you can.
And Colorado,
and,
yeah, it's brilliant.
And as any good mentor or parent, all of your children are your favorite children, I'm sure. I wish I didn't know about lunch shaming. We represent school cafeteria workers in Dallas and Houston, and are often involved in issues of preventing that kind of shaming and monitor that in some other places where we organize. But, you know, I can remember when, you know, those people getting free lunches back decades ago were also stigmatized in that way. Now, the way the public school system is, the majority of people are often getting those things. But that's a great project. One of the things in the notes I got was, I gather on Peace First that y'all recommend that the youth in the program read something by somebody they disagree with on a regular, almost daily basis. What's the strategy there, Eric? That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't need to tell you or your listeners how painful the divisions in our country feel. And for many folks, this is not new. This is their lived experience. One of our main messages is that we often conflate understanding and condoning. And we actually feel those are two very different things. You know, that we can work to understand someone, who they are, what they're passionate about, what they care about, without agreeing with anything that they're saying. And we can build those levels of understanding, and that is essential for a healthy democracy. Like, we need to see one another, and that we can see one another without agreeing. And so the practices we're trying to help young people to do is how do you actually see people who are different from you? And I mean, really see them, understand them, listen to their stories. And maybe you'll find common ground on one piece you could work on, and maybe you won't. But that practice is essential for building the beloved community.
Gotcha. So how do you ever think about aging out of the youth business, Eric? I mean, I was once on a board called the Youth Project a long time ago, and I used to ask them, well, isn't there an age where you can't be on the board because you're no longer a youth? But how does that look for you as you stand at the nexus of this organization?
I love the question, and I am thinking about my early retirement now that I'm 44 daily, and already identifying the next young leader who will take my place. It's been interesting. We've been supporting a lot of young people connected to the Parkland shootings, either directly or we're inspired by the youth activism from that. And there's this narrative that generated from that experience that at first I really loved. And the narrative was, look, our generation, the older generation, has messed things up. Young people got this. Like, they will come and save us. And what I was hearing back from young people was really, as they heard that, they're like, yeah, no.
Right.
Y'all messed this up. You've got a responsibility to fix it. But let's do it together. So for me, as a former youth leader, youth organizer, is now understanding myself as an elder. You know, the Quakers have this wonderful concept of eldering, where my job is not to do things anymore, but really build the container and support this generation of young people that are coming up. The four most powerful words you can ever say to a young person is, how can I help? Right? And so my message. That's our message.
And you have a program. You could end up transitioning over to run the Mentors program. Eric, before we leave, tell people how they can get your book, how they can become a mentor, how they can donate to Peace First.
So the book is everywhere. It's in your local bookstore, which I encourage you to support. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon. It's super cheap. I think it's under $10. Buy a copy for the kids you love in your life. Buy one for your shelf. It's full of inspiring stories. And then peacefirst.org is our digital home. And I'd love to invite your listeners to come, even just to engage with exciting, interesting stories.
Eric, thank you so much. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sings, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.
Thanks.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.